You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network special series, New Books and Celebration Studies. My name is Emily Allen, and I'm the host for this episode. Our guest for today is Dr. Ray Allen, author of Jump Up, Caribbean Carnival Music in New York City, published by Oxford University Press in 2019. Jump Up, Caribbean Carnival Music in New York City is a comprehensive history of Trinidadian calypso and steel band music in the diaspora. Blending urban studies, oral history, archival research, and ethnography, Jump Up examines how members of New York's diverse Anglophile Caribbean communities forged transnational identities through the self-conscious embrace, transformation, and hybridization of select carnival musical styles and performances. The book addresses the issues of music, migration, and identity, exploring the complex cycling of musical practices and the back-and-forth movement of singers, musicians, arrangers, producers, and cultural entrepreneurs between New York's diasporic communities and the Caribbean. And our guest, Dr. Ray Allen, is professor of music at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center. So welcome, Dr. Ray Allen.
Well, thank you so much. It's an honor to be here with you.
Yeah, looking forward to our chat. So before we get into the book, would you mind telling us a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. Well, I'm, as you said, I'm an ethnomusicologist. Been teaching at Brooklyn College for many years. I was actually born and raised in a New York suburb out on Long Island, but I've been living here in Brooklyn since 1985. So I kind of feel Brooklyn is my home. It's where my kids were brought up and so forth. I play the piano a bit, but I'm not really a musician. I'm a scholar and writer. And I should say from the outset that I am not Caribbean or West Indian. I am white. And so I come to this as something of a cultural outsider. However, since I have, as I said, lived in Brooklyn for so many years, I've been going to Brooklyn's Carnival since 1984. So I'm more than a casual observer, let's say that. I've had many West Indian students at Brooklyn College. So I feel a real connection to the community in that sense. Just to identify myself, I am not Caribbean, nor do I play in a steel band or so forth. I come to it, as an outsider looking in, but as one who's quite attached to the community. So how's that?
Yeah, I think that helps a lot with kind of framing, the context in which this book, came you know, in that way. And I'm interested to hear more too about what you were just mentioning, your first experiences of, you know, the Brooklyn Carnival in 1984. What was that like for you?
Sure. Well, I was a graduate student at the University of Pennsylvania then, and one of our had a class in Afro diasporic music, including carnival music, New World carnivals. One of our professors, Morton Marks, you know, who lived in Brooklyn, said, you know, you guys ought to come up, you know, Penn is in Philadelphia, he said, you guys got to get on the train and come up here and have a look at this. It's an amazing event, this West Indian Carnival. It takes place on Labor Day. And one of my buddies and I did this, and I was just truly mesmerized. I had one of those epiphany moments, you know, when I saw Eastern Parkway with just the throngs of people pulling steel bands up the parkway, the big trucks playing. Let me start that again. And the big sound trucks playing, you know, the latest soca hits and so forth. And it was just totally amazing. And in those days, you could go out into the parade itself, into the crowd. They didn't have the barriers that they do today. And so, you know, it's quite participatory in that sense. So, you know, we got out there and helped pull one of the steel pans up the parkway, one of the steel bands up the parkway. And as I say, it was just this amazing moment. I fell in love with the music. And ever since then, I, you know, have been going to Carnival. So, I was a convert early on.
Yeah, and that's interesting to hear about your experiences, early experiences rather, in Carnival and, you know, having gone through your book, how much you've, you know, experienced it over the years and, you know, what has now become, like you're saying, a home. So that's really interesting positionality wise in what you bring to the table there. And then another kind of like contextual question here, you know, maybe a more obvious question. What does the first part of your book's title, Jump Up, refer to?
Oh, sure. Well, Jump Up is a kind of general term in West Indian culture and carnival that means just the kind of exuberant, let yourself go, dance, literally jump up in the air. You know, a lot of Afro-Caribbean dancing is getting low and going down with the hips and so forth, but it's also a kind of verticality of jumping up and down to the beat, especially to very loud, bass-heavy soca music. And so jumping up means just, you know, getting out there and dancing. And that sort of captures the essence of this incredibly vibrant celebratory music that happens during Carnival. So, yeah, Jump Up. And there are many songs that, you know, with the title Everybody Jump Up and Wave Your Flag, so forth and so on. So it seems like an appropriate title.
Yeah, that's – I wish I could – I'll have to – try to watch, I guess, footage of these carnival celebrations, because now I'm kind of intrigued by, you're talking about how participatory it was, like without the barriers and this idea of Jump Up. That sounds really, like I said earlier, fun and very interesting.
Let me just encourage everybody listening to just hop onto YouTube and just put in Brooklyn Carnival, and you'll find numerous YouTubes of various quality, but videos of the Eastern Parkway Carnival quote parade, and you'll get a sense of just how stuffed with people it is, how dense and how much activity is going on and so forth. So yeah, please, it's on YouTube. Take advantage.
Yeah, that sounds like a great idea to do, to kind of bring more a multi-sensory aspect to the text too in that way. And then going into the book itself, of course, you know, starting in the introduction, you know, you kind of lay a couple of ideas out for the readers that I think kind of help clarify the through lines, you know, of the text. You know, the first of which is that idea of diasporic transnationalism, which is a way to, quote, describe the cyclical flow of musical expressions among multiple sites. And then the other idea being hybridization, which is, quote, the dynamic mixing that takes place during cross-cultural contact. So can you kind of explain to our listeners how these ideas play out, you know, in these processes that have led to the manifestation of Carnival in New York from Trinidad?
Sure. Well, the idea of diasporic transnationalism is something that's become increasingly popular in global studies, and particularly global cultural studies and ethnomusicology. So the old model was that people, in terms of diasporic flow of culture, people would come from someplace and they'd bring their culture with them, including their music, and they'd land there, and then, you know, the music would somehow develop. And there wasn't a lot of contact back with the homeland from where they came. And so if you're, say, dealing with 19th century Irish music and a fiddler who came to New York, say, in 1870, brings his fiddle and helps establish an Irish dance ceilidh scene here in New York, that guy is probably not going to be going back and forth to Ireland a whole lot. It was pretty rough getting over here on the boat, right? And there was no recordings of the music that was going on in Ireland or here in New York at that time. And there was no telephone. And goodness knows there was no internet, imagine. So the flow of culture was often seen as sort of, you know, unidirectional. I mean, imagine the same thing with a Jewish klezmer musician coming, landing in New York, say, in the year 1900. You know, escaping the pogroms of Eastern Europe, they're not going to be doing a lot of going back. So it was a kind of unidirectional flow when that, say, clarinet player brought his music here. So what happened, particularly in the second half of the 20th century, with an increase in mobility because of air travel, increase in communications with telephone, and very important, of course, the proliferation of recordings on discs, records, that is, all of a sudden you could have this real kind of mixing between multiple sites going on. So someone might come from someplace with a music tradition, but they would be going back home on occasions, and they would be listening to recordings from back home. And so all kinds of mixing could be going on. They could bring traditions from here back home. So now think of somebody in, say, the late 1960s coming from Trinidad to Brooklyn. That person would be able to go back home to Carnival in Trinidad and be going back and forth. They could listen to recordings of the latest Calypso songs from Trinidad. They could take recordings of Calypso music made in New York and Brooklyn and take it back to Trinidad. And so you get this idea of a cyclical flow. And that's what I think we mean by diasporic transnationalism. And that's the way you have to understand Carnival music as part of this system. Again, multi-sites, Trinidad, other Caribbean islands, Brooklyn. There are also big diasporic carnivals in Toronto and in Notting Hill, London. And those things all form this sort of network. Now, my book is specifically about the diaspora to Brooklyn, or, well, to Harlem and Brooklyn. I just make some slight mention of the other carnivals, especially Toronto and Notting Hill, London. Somebody now needs to take on that big project of trying to do a comparative study of those three, and maybe add Miami in there for big diasporic carnivals based on the Trinidad model. That would be really interesting. So if there are some ambitious young scholars out there, there's a project for you.
Good luck with that, whoever it is.
Right.
But yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and I think helps paint the picture for, you know, this book and how all these different, you know, your case studies that you put in this larger New York scene, where they come from and whatnot. And you lay that out.
Let me just say that with hybridity, just very quickly, you know, this is a concept that's pretty well established now, that you can't study African-derived musics, Afro-diasporic musics in the New World without, you know, thinking a lot about hybridity, the blending of cultures. And we'll see that the forms we're looking at here, calypso, steel band, soca, they are a blend. They're heavily African in their roots and ancestry, but they absorbed a lot of European music too, and that's very much the story of music in the Caribbean. They're hybrids of Afro and Euro-American musical traditions, although they're actualized primarily by Afro-Caribbean people, but there's European influence too. So understanding hybridization is key to, first of all, understanding the music of the Caribbean. Then you get this second layer of hybridization when people from the Caribbean come to North America, come to New York, Harlem and Brooklyn, and they hear all this other amazing music, jazz and blues and R&B and hip hop, and they start to mix those with their, let's say, calypso and soca music, So you get hybridization on top of hybridization and multi-hybridized forms. And in a way, anyway, that's what Soca, Soul Calypso, that's what it is. So hybridization is central to what we're doing.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, when I think about New York, just kind of in a general sense to the, you know, larger area, I mean, there's so much going on there with hybridization for sure.
Absolutely. There's so much more to go into that I couldn't do in the book, but I'm just trying to lay out some of the big parameters, you know, the way the different island musics interacted with each other here in New York, the way they interacted with Black American music, with Latin music here in New York. So New York is such an incredible melting pot of different music traditions, especially Caribbean traditions, that it's just an amazing place to study.
Absolutely. I think there's so much to go into there. And just that one scene alone, let alone the multi-sided idea that you posited too. Backtracking a little bit to something you were getting at earlier, you know, kind of mapping out these networks, you know, in chapter one, I thought it was really useful how you kind of laid out first what was going on with, you know, Trinidad Carnival historically and kind of as a whole, just to kind of, again, make it easier to follow that network over to New York, of course. And in chapter one, I thought it was interesting how you kind of laid out four different themes about Trinidad Carnival, you know, that tradition as participatory ritual, presentation and commodity, resistance and identity, and diasporic expression. So how do those four through lines contextualize and help us understand the Harlem and Brooklyn carnivals?
Sure. Let me just say that this first chapter is really meant for people who may not know so much about Calypso and Steel Band. And it may be that some people who do know may want to skip this chapter, but I felt like I need to give some foundation. So, for beginning, carnival in Trinidad is participatory ritual. Carnival came out of the emancipation celebrations of the African slaves, the Kambole celebrations, beginning in the around 1835. And they were laid on top of the European idea of carnival, the sort of pre-Lent festival. It is ritual and people are supposed to participate. Okay, you're supposed to drum and sing and dance and jump up and be part of the ritual. It's not something that's just necessarily stuck on a stage. So it's important to understand that. On the other hand, it has become, by the time we get to the 20th century in Trinidad, there is a strong presentational aspect to it and a commodification of it, that we had professional calypso singers who would perform and be paid, and audiences would sit down in these venues called calypso tents and listen to them sing the way we maybe think of in a Western idea of a quote concert, which was not something that was part of the early Kambole celebrations, where, you know, everybody's in it together singing and dancing. And then, of course, you get recordings, and all of a sudden recordings are commodifying sound and being sold. So there's a huge history of the recording of calypso music in Trinidad and in Harlem and in Brooklyn and so forth. So that's an important part of the story. I'll just keep running down here. You mentioned that resistance and identity. Because Trinidadian Carnival grew out of the Kambole emancipation celebrations. By nature, it's resistance. It's showing that, you know, the slaves are saying, we're now free. We have resisted and broken the chains. And so that kind of theme continues through, because remember, slavery ends in Trinidad, but the British continue to control things. You know, it's a colony up until the 1960s. So while all this carnival is developing, there is still a very repressive British regime kind of, you know, trying to hold back the majority African population. And carnival was one way of expressing some resistance to that. Sometimes it was just in doing your African drumming and dancing. There's a lot of satire involved in carnival in terms of the songs and the costumes, and often satirizing the powerful and the British elite or the French elite. Resistance is extremely important, and then establishing this identity as African people in the New World. It's a diasporic expression, as I said, because, you know, Trinidad couldn't hold its carnival. It just spread out. When people left the Caribbean, they brought carnival with them, whether it was Brooklyn or Toronto or London or Washington or Miami, and just the different Caribbean islands. So by its very nature, where Caribbean people land, they seem to bring carnival with them. So that was the kind of foundation I wanted people to have. To now, let's look at what actually developed. Let's start with Harlem. So,
yeah, I think that helps a lot in making the text approachable in that way for any kind of reader, which, and you know, I think is good for understanding those bigger ideas that you were getting at about those four themes, for instance. So, and I definitely think you can see those, you know, very evidently in the chapters that follow that more hone in on New York itself. So I found that really useful as guidepost, if you will, throughout the rest of the text. And then, so also going on to, you know, more of the, you know, New York scene, you know, in chapters 2 and 3, that's kind of where you get into, you know, the heart of the text, going into talking about how the Calypso shows that first started in Harlem's club and dance halls from the 1930s to 1950s, and then, of course, carried over into Harlem Carnival from the 1940s and 1960s. So starting with Harlem, what were these performances like, these Calypso performances, in the clubs and halls versus the streets during this time?
Well, what you got by the 1930s was a tradition of having carnival dances in Harlem. Now, remember, the initial West Indian population is developing basically in Harlem, some in the South Bronx, some over in Brooklyn, but Harlem was really the center of things pre-war and really until the 1960s. So you had these big dance halls, and people started having these carnival dances around the time that carnival would be taking place back in Trinidad, which was the weekend before Ash Wednesday in February. And of course, here in New York, it was too cold to be outside doing carnival the way you did in Trinidad or anywhere in the Caribbean or New Orleans. And so people would have dances. And of course, dances, balls, they were part of carnival back in Trinidad. So it wasn't like some new tradition. And what you would be have orchestras, maybe 12-piece orchestras, a rhythm section, a couple of horns, and possibly a singer sometimes just instrumental. And they would do calypso tunes that were associated with carnival back home. They'd also do Latin numbers like rumbas and tango, and occasionally some American popular music, like the jazz music, swing music that was popular. So they would have these dances, and you'd have clusters of them in the winter, again, celebrating carnival and billed as carnival dances. And there were also costume dances. And I don't mean like everybody just, okay, I'll come with my own costume and let's see what happens, the way we maybe think of a costume party, in the modern America. But groups would get together around a theme, and the groups were called MAS bands, M-A-S, as in Trinidad. And so they'd all come dressed around a theme, like maybe they'd be Indians, or maybe they'd be sailors, or maybe they'd be butterflies, any number of things, but they would come in costumes. And so you'd have your dance, and then at some point, they'd have what was called the Dame Lorraine call. Dame Lorraine was a carnival figure, a kind of plump woman who often represented the aristocracy, who people would satirize and make fun of during carnival. But they actually called these Dame Lorraine dances. But they would have the call, and they'd say, okay, now each mass band will get to come out and show their stuff. And if I thought it'd be fun to just read this one little quick section here, because it's out of the New York Sun, which was a New York city paper. And this, I believe, was 1941. But if I could, I'm going to go ahead and read it. The Dame Lorraine call at an early Renaissance casino show. The Renaissance casino was a big hall. Okay, was preceded by a series of recitations in patois dialogue as masqueraders that reeked with the same bawdy humor which marked the Elizabethan era. So you can imagine the sort of almost theatrical kind of presentation from each group of someone reading, reciting some sort of poem. Then the densely packed dance floor then eventually was taken over by a collection of bats and vampires. It was this last group rushing onto the floor, screeching and waving their wings, who cleared sufficient space for the rest of the maskers to present tableaus to the judges. The band of bats and vampires was, however, penalized because they persisted in dancing all the time rather than assuming the required final pose in front of the judges. They were demoted to third place, running behind the winning groups of mermaids and a second place band depicting Cleopatra and her attendants. So that kind of gives you a nice sense of what this must have been like. The band is playing a calypso, and out these different moss bands come, and they get out there and dance for a minute and then freeze in a tableau, and the judges would look at their costumes, and then they would award prizes. And of course, the idea of prizes for the best costumes was part of the Trinidadian carnival tradition. So that's carried on, but now indoors in these kind of dances. So that's what the dances were like. That's what persisted up until we finally get our first street carnival in 1947. And what happened then was a woman named Jessie Wardle and a Trinidad masked man named Rufus Gorin were finally able to get a permit close down an area on 7th Avenue in Harlem and have an outdoor parade. Now, of course, this isn't really going to work very well in February during real carnival season because it's cold here, as we all know. Just looking out my window now at the snow. What they decided to do, and they worked it out with the city, was that they were going to have carnival on Labor Day weekend. Because that was a weekend when a lot of people were out of town and you could close down streets. And so in 1947, they had the first Caribbean carnival in Harlem on Labor Day weekend. And the parade, quote, parade, went down Fifth Avenue up from Fifth Avenue to 110th Street and then up 7th Avenue up to about 142nd Street, where they went to a ballroom and had a dance. And that was the first carnival. Now, it's interesting because the initial parades from our accounts of oral history and newspaper accounts, it was a combination of a conventional, let's say, American Western parade that had marching bands from high schools and people representing different community organizations marching along carefully, in line in a kind of a military model. But then they had this carnival stuff, people dressed in these wild costumes. And pretty soon, let me say, the initial ones, it seems that we think that the music was being provided by calypso singers who were on little flatbed trucks singing, maybe with a couple instruments, and very light amplification, if any amplification, maybe a bullhorn, right? Nothing like the thunderous sound trucks that we have today. And so that provided the music for people to dance, jump up, if you will, yeah. And then we get our first reports of steel bands. And people didn't quite know what to make of these things. They called them kettle drums, and they called them oil drums and so forth. But the earliest steel pans were a steel pan drum cut from an oil drum, a single pan worn around someone's neck with a strap, and it was called pan around the neck. And we have some wonderful pictures of some of these pan bands from the late 40s and into the 1950s. Rudy King was one of the famous pan men who brought one of the first pan bands out to Harlem Carnival. And when these pan bands would play, people would jump into the street, or jump, off the sidewalks into the streets. And so the whole parade structure would break down and you have more of a carnival feel to it rather than a formal parade. And of course, the authorities didn't always like that. And, because they wanted an orderly parade and the steel bands would slow things down. And so it was a kind of a conundrum for the people organizing it. They wanted the steel bands there to attract the people, but the steel bands kind of slowed things down and wrecked the structure of their carefully put together parade. So this is what went on then for 15 years up until the early 1960s. That was what the parade was like in Harlem. And when the parade was over, people would go into a ballroom and they'd have a dance similar to what I just described before. And people would come in costumes and you'd have an orchestra playing calypso tunes. And some of those calypso singers would get up and sing. And people really felt a sense of this carnival.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
That sounds like a blast. Oh my gosh.
Yes.
I would love to have seen that. Oh my gosh. And it's interesting to, you know, the tensions there between kind of like this formality of it versus maybe the more improvisatory aspects of that too. That sounds like happened with things like getting the permit and whatnot for that. So it's really interesting to hear about that history behind that. And then, of course, that led to the Brooklyn Carnival, which you get at in the next chapter 4, you know, saying that that one stemmed from, quote, the mass immigration of English-speaking Caribbean people in the wake of the new 1965 immigration laws. And so you mentioned that Harlem Carnival was a template, more or less, for Brooklyn's Carnival. But what differences do we see surface in this Brooklyn version?
The main difference, I would say, with the Brooklyn Carnival was just the size or magnitude of it. Like the Harlem Carnival, there was centered in like one big, well, let's just call it a quote parade or a carnival parade. But then there were dances and presentations and concerts and so forth before and after. In many ways, the Harlem parade sort of set the stage for a multi-day long weekend celebration. But the Brooklyn one was much, much bigger. We have reports of tens and hundreds of thousands of people in some of the earliest Eastern Parkway parades, which started in 1971. And very quickly, people are talking about a million people on Eastern Parkway, which is a lot of people. So again, the size and scope of it were much more. And I can go into specifics on that, or what would you like me to say?
Yeah, you can go for it. It'd be interesting to hear more about that.
Basically, the setting, the way the Brooklyn Carnival developed was you had a series of evening concerts in back of the Brooklyn Museum. The Brooklyn Museum sits right off of Grand Army Plaza, which is the centerpiece of Central Brooklyn. It's the head of Prospect Park, and on the other side is the beginning of Grand Army. The beginning of Eastern Parkway, which was Olmsted's Grand Boulevard that headed out east from Central Brooklyn. And so, in back of the museum, they would have calypso concerts. Actually, what they would call a Dimanche Gras concert, which would, you know, kind of helped start off a lot of carnival activities. And that would feature leading calypsonians, many of whom were actually brought from Trinidad, which was kind of interesting, because now in the 1960s, or oh, sorry, the 1970s, and now in the 1970s, It's easy to bring people up from Trinidad with air flights. You didn't have to put them on a boat and, you know, take a week or something to get up here. People could fly up for concerts and do a few shows and go back home. So you get that more transnational feel to things. So you had the Moshkra concerts, and then you had the Steel Pan competition, or Panorama, which was a big, big deal in Trinidad. From the, I guess the 1960s on, and Brooklyn has its first panorama in 1972, a year after the first parade. That panorama is also in back of the Brooklyn Museum, not on the scale of the Trinidad panorama by any means. The first Brooklyn panoramas only had maybe half a dozen bands competing, but this idea of having the steel band competition, having a Dimash Gras show, and then having the big, what's called the road march, the big parade, were based on the Trinidad model, and that's how they developed in Brooklyn. There was one more component, and maybe we'll get to this later, of the Brooklyn Carnival called Juve, which was early morning celebration on Monday morning, Sunday night, Monday morning of was a big Juve, which was the big celebration kicking off all of carnival events. It would take place Sunday night or Monday morning. And that was not added to the Brooklyn Carnival until the 1990s. So that became a little bit later. And maybe we'll wait and talk about that if you want. But that's basically how it got established in Brooklyn, and as a very big, big, huge event. Most of the music coming down the parkway during the road march was supplied by steel bands. And you have multiple steel pans on racks being rolled and pushed and pulled by people. Eventually, small trucks started pulling them. But you could have 50, 60 people in one of these steel bands coming down Eastern Parkway. And then their fans and the different MOS bands, that is the Masqueraders, would surround them, and up the parkway they would go. And that was part of this whole just complete ritualized catharsis, if you will, of pure joy that Carnival was all about. And that was the first thing I saw when I came to Carnival in 1985. That so pulled me in. What eventually happens is that sound systems get bigger and more powerful, and they start to mount the sound systems on trucks. So now you can have trucks, and we're talking big trucks, semi-trucks, go down the parkway that would either carry a live band with a lot of amplification or DJs just spinning the latest discs, but very, very loud, heavy bass-driven music, which was great for dancing, but not so good for the steel band because it drowned out the steel pans. And eventually, the steel pans, orchestras began to disappear from Eastern Parkway. It's a slow process beginning in the 80s. And but by the 90s, very few steel bands were actually part of the afternoon road march. And in fact, if you go today, I don't think you'll see a steel band. I don't think I've seen one for several years on Eastern Parkway. However, the steel bands land in Juve, the early morning parade, where the organizers decided that they were going to have steel pan only, no DJs, no amplification. And so it's a very interesting kind of revitalization and nod toward tradition that they wanted to preserve this older pan on the road, they would call it. And so it's you have that too. So for people who like the older, to actually hear pure steel band music on the road with people jumping up and, you know, dancing along, you can go to Juve. And then if you want the big sound trucks with the latest soca sound being blasted at bone-crushing volume, go up the Eastern Parkway and jump up there. So it's kind of, you know, tradition and modernity kind of, you know, all there together for you.
Yeah, while we're on Juve, we can maybe like elaborate on that too, to give our listeners some context. So you've already talked about some of the differences, particularly, for instance, like you were talking about with the steel bands being a little bit more prominent in Juve, you know, compared to like the main like Brooklyn Carnival. But what are some other differences we see in that early morning celebration?
Okay, so Juve means break of day. And Juve celebrations in Trinidad are what starts the carnival weekend, basically. The Juve celebration will begin at night. In Brooklyn, it would begin like 3-4 a.m. in the morning, and then continue into the day as the sun comes up. And that's the Juve, the French for break of day, what it means. And again, it was honoring or grew out of the emancipation celebrations. And so, while during the day on the parkway, the costumes are very bright, shiny beads, very fancy, big, all kinds of accoutrements with them. In Juve, the costumes are very, just the opposite. They're very simple. They're earthy. People wear torn up clothes. People put mud on them. People put oil on them. People put paint on them. And it's all kind of, kind of referencing back to thinking about the slaves. There are jab-jab devils who dress up as devils and completely blacken themselves as a kind of, again, mocking the devilish masters, who oversaw the sugarcane fields and so forth. People would dress up in chains, again, as a nod towards slavery and so forth. So the costuming is totally different. And if you go to Juve, don't wear fancy clothes because people might come up and grab you and get mud and paint and stuff on you. I have my special Juve shirt that I wear. A very, very different kind of feel to the costuming. The music is only acoustic steel band and percussion. There are no DJs or sound systems during Juve. I don't know how they did it, but amazingly now, since 1994, when they did the first Juve, they've never had any problem. Nobody has come with sound systems. People respect this idea of let's hear pure steel pan music, unamplified. Let's hear percussion ensembles that remind us of our African heritage and so forth. And that's what that celebration is all about. It's a classic kind of revitalization movement, what anthropologists would say, and that people were worried that the steel pan on the road was disappearing in Brooklyn. And so they kind of created this Juve tradition with no DJs allowed. And what's really interesting is that Juve back in Trinidad, which has a lot of these acoustic, a lot of steel bands and percussion ensembles, but they also have DJs. During Juve in Trinidad. And so it's kind of interesting that the most pure pan music, or the way it, quote, used to be, nostalgic music, is happening in the diaspora, not back in Trinidad. I find that quite interesting, and it's something that probably needs to be explored a little bit more. Anyway, so that's what Juve is about, and it's now become an established part of Carnival. It's run by the Juve City International, which is a different organization than the West Indian American Day Carnival Association, which runs the big Eastern Parkway Road March and concerts and so forth. So that's kind of the two parts of Carnival that I would say really complement each other, even though one, at first sight, well, one looks real traditional and one looks real modern, but both are important, and many, many people go to both of them. So most interesting.
Yeah, that helps a lot with kind of painting the picture of that broader scene, I think, and how different the different soundscapes are, I guess, of those two different parts. So appreciate that you clarifying all that. I think that will help our listeners quite a bit. And then you also mentioned an organization that I was actually going to ask about, the, you know, kind of backing organization of the main Brooklyn Carnival, the West Indian American Carnival Day Association. And I found it interesting that in the book, you mentioned that they were promoting a quote unquote one people Pan-Caribbean narrative in Brooklyn Carnival, at least in the 70s and 80s. So, you know, you were talking about the different, you know, types of music in that. So how did all that music play into that one people theme? And, you know, why were they doing this? And how was that narrative received by the communities?
Well, Very interesting. Carlos Lozada, who was one of the founding members of the West Indian American Day Carnival Association and the president and the driving force behind that organization and Brooklyn Carnival for many, many years. He was Trinidadian who had worked in the transit system in the subways. But he quickly realized that, Carnival and Carnival music was a way of bringing together or hopefully bringing together the different Caribbean immigrant groups who from the different islands and nations that were now living in Brooklyn. Now, remember, the majority Trinidadians were not the majority of, quote, West Indians in Brooklyn. Okay. The biggest numbers were actually from Jamaica. Jamaica did not have a carnival back in the 1970s. Okay, they had a bit of a calypso tradition, but the music coming out of Jamaica was reggae, right? No carnival tradition, so the whole idea of carnival was a little bit foreign to Brooklyn's largest West Indian group. Then there were people from other islands besides Trinidad was probably second in terms of population from what we know, but then you have a lot of people from Barbados, coastal Guyana, Grenada, St. Lucia, particularly St. Vincent. Antigua. And, those places, some of them had carnivals, but they weren't as developed as Trinidad's. A few of them, like Antigua, and had some steel band tradition, but not a lot. So all of a sudden, they're being presented with, all these West Indian people, some of who are not that familiar with carnival, are being presented with, okay, here's this event. You all need to come together because we can all be one. But the whole model was Trinidadian. And Lozoma and the people who were running the West Indian American Day Carnival Association were Trinidadian, almost all of them. So there was that tension there, are we all one or not? And musically, the biggest kind of way that manifests itself, that tension, was the sonic battles between reggae music, obviously Jamaican music, right, which was coming out of sound systems initially on the sides of Eastern Parkway, set up on the road on the side, and the calypso and soca music, which was Trinidadian, which was coming off the trucks and the steel bands going down the parkway. And eventually the reggae, the Jamaicans got their sound trucks also to play reggae music. And so when you go out there on the parkway, yeah, you got all these Caribbean people together, which is what Lozama wanted. But in certain ways, music kind of helped keep them a little bit apart. I like to think of it as the parkway is like a the Caribbean Sea, the ocean, and then you have these different islands, and the islands are the sound trucks with people around them. But there'll be a Trinidadian sound truck playing the latest Trinidadian soca tune and everybody waving their Trinidadian flags. And then along will come another truck with playing reggae with surrounded by people wearing Jamaican flag paraphernalia and waving Jamaican flags. And then there'll be one from Barbados that's playing the music of one of the Barbadian calypso singers, and people will have their Barbadian flags. So it's interesting. In one way, we're all one that we're out here on the parkway, but we're still maintaining our kind of little tribal island groups. They still kind of, form their own little tribal island groups, which is really interesting. But again, I think it's a way of mediating the kind of dual identities that people have. Yes, I'm Afro-Caribbean, but I'm also Trinidadian. Okay, and that's different than Jamaican. And yet, I'm part of the Caribbean West Indian community and we're all out here. So in a way, I think the parade and the music's helped people maintain identity while also feeling some sense of coming together. Now, the steel bands are also problematic in sense of creating, we are all one, because the steel bands came from Trinidad. And everybody agrees on that. And when you read the publicity that the West Indian American Day Carnival Association puts out and the annual booklets that they put out, they make a big deal. Steel pan is the Trinidadian national instrument. And it did spread to some other islands. So you have some steel pan traditions in Antigua and coastal Guyana and so forth. But this is Trinidadian music. And if you look at the early steel bands in the 70s and 80s, they were mostly Trinidadians playing, all the arrangers, all the band leaders were Trinidadian. All the music that was being played were the calypsos from Trinidad. I think there was one group from the Virgin Islands that competed once in Panorama. But almost all the groups were Trinidadian. Now, slowly that's changed, and you see more and more people from different islands coming in to the steel bands. So you get more people, say from Jamaica or Grenada or Barbados playing in these bands. But there's still, the model is Trinidadian. It's Trinidadian, a Trinidadian instrument. Trinidadians are the arrangers. The tunes are from Trinidad. And so, again, there's a bit of a tension there in terms of creating a really, what would you say, more kind of ecumenical, diverse Caribbean unit. It's still Trinidad kind of rules heavily in terms of the steel bands. So that's a bit of a paradox. It's just as how much did the music really make us all one? And again, I think it's just one of those dialectic tensions that on one hand, yeah, we're all playing this and we recognize that we're all from the Caribbean West Indies, but we still have individual, you know, island affiliations. When it comes to steel band, it's really a Trinidadian tradition. So
interesting. Yeah, definitely some dissonance on that. Interesting, though, like representations and all of that. And I was thinking about it. We've been talking a lot about, so far, more what's been going on with these kind of live performances, either in the, you know, private venues or in the streets, but we haven't really talked about recordings yet. So, you know, in your chapter 6 to 7, you talk a lot about Brooklyn Soaker recordings from like the 70s to the 1990s. So can you talk a little bit about those and how those also kind of reflect what we were just talking about, these Trinidadian and as well as like larger U.S. influences?
Sure. Well, first of all, to take a bigger historical scope, you have to understand that many of the first recordings of calypso music going back to the 1920s were actually made in New York, not Trinidad, because they didn't have recording studios back then in Trinidad of any of size and quality. So most of the early recordings of calypso music especially from the 20s and 30s, into the 40s, most of them were made either here in New York or by American companies that went down to Trinidad, you know, with portable stuff. So that changes in the 50s and 60s, and more studios start to develop in Trinidad and recording goes on there. But getting back to, you know, your question about soca music, which is developing in the 1970s, what happened was that Brooklyn became a center for the recording of a lot of soca music beginning really in the 1970s. And that was due very much because of two individuals. Granville Straker, who owns Straker Records, and anyone who knows anything about calypso, you know that many of the records that were made in the 70s and 80s and 90s came on Straker Records. He was from St. Vincent, interestingly enough. And he came here as an immigrant. He was a cab driver, and then he started selling records out of a shop. And eventually, he developed his own record company called Straker Records. The other individual who's important here was Ralston Charles. Similar biography, except he came. He was born in Tobago, but you know, grew up in Port of Spain in Trinidad, and then he came to Brooklyn in, I think, 1967. You know, right as the new immigration law was opening up for people to come. And he eventually starts a record store and then his own recording company, Charlie's Records. A little bit later, a guy named Michael Gould founded Bee's Records. So by the time you get to 1980, all the best recording studios were here in Brooklyn and Manhattan. Sometimes they go to Manhattan to record, but here in New York, not back in Trinidad. And you have these entrepreneurs, Straker and Charles, who put these big companies together. They brought calypsonians up from Trinidad and St. Vincent and other islands. They would record them, and then they would press their records, and the records would be sold here in Brooklyn to the growing West Indian population who wanted music from back home. And the records, would, of course, would be sent back to Trinidad and the other islands where they'd sell there. So now, again, you get this transnational loop we're talking about, right? And Brooklyn becomes very central. It ended up that a number of the important people who arranged the music, who would score out the parts for the band and organize the recording sessions, also were based here in Brooklyn. The most important of them was Frankie McIntosh, also from St. Vincent, but who came to New York in 1969, went to Brooklyn College and got a bachelor's degree in music and then a master's degree from NYU. And he became like Brooklyn's main arranger of soca music, working for Granville Straker in the 70s and 80s. I'm sorry, did I say he was also from St. Vincent, not Trinidad. Frankie McIntosh was from St. Vincent. So New York, I mean, at Brooklyn. And so Brooklyn sort of becomes this hub, if you will, of soca music, with people coming here. Some Calypsonians actually move here to New York and use New York as their base. Important people like the Mighty Sparrow, who is probably the most important Calypsonian of his generation. He moves to Queens in the 1960s, and he's back and forth between here and Trinidad. Calypso Rose, the queen of Calypso music, the most important female Calypsonian, moves to New York in the late 1970s. Lord Nelson, another great Calypsonian from Tobago and Trinidad, moves here actually in the late 1950s and takes up residency here. So you had people who lived here, you had people visiting, and New York becomes really, and particularly Brooklyn, becomes the center of the soca world in the 1980s. Let me give you an example, if I could, of a song that really, I think, tells this story well. So Calypso Rose comes to New York. She has finally won the Calypso monarchy in Trinidad, first woman to do so. But she sees there's more probably opportunity here in New York in terms of playing engagements and recording. So she moves to New York. But she also needs a day job. So she decides she's going to get trained in some sort of health field, and she's taking classes in Manhattan for it. So one day, she's riding the F train in from Queens to Manhattan, and she's like grooving on the clickety-clickety-clickety-clickety-clickety-clickety of the train tracks. So she gets to her school where she's taking this class, runs into the women's room, and writes the lyrics to a song called Give Me Tempo. And that was, you know, inspired by this subway sound. Now, the song itself is actually about going to carnival in San Fernando in Trinidad, all right? So she did what people did back then. She takes her guitar and puts on a cassette recorder. Some of your older listeners may remember what cassette recordings are. And, you know, sings the song, takes the cassette, brings it over to Ralston Charles, who has his record store and company there on Fulton Street in Brooklyn. So people refer to him as Charlie, listen to him, say, yeah, I think this is really something good. So he sends the cassette down to Trinidad and has an arranger try to put a part to it. So next trip down to Trinidad, Charlie stops in and sees this guy, listens to his arranger, says, nah, I don't really like this. And so he takes it to another arranger, a guy named Pelham Goddard, who was kind of unheard of at that point in Trinidad. And Goddard puts a tune together, an arrangement together, and they record the rhythm section and the horns, and they send those tapes back to Brooklyn. And then Rose comes in and sings the main vocal. Charlie puts the whole thing together and has a record that he's selling both in Brooklyn and in Trinidad. And in Trinidad, it's so popular, it wins what's called the Road March, which is the most popular Calypso soca tune of the year in 1977. First time a woman had ever won the Road March. So there you go. Give Me Tempo. You know, is it a Brooklyn song? Is it a Trinidad song? It's a transnational song, the way it was all put together. So I think that's a wonderful example that shows the importance of Brooklyn and yet the sort of this interaction between Brooklyn and Trinidad, which created this really great soca music during the 70s and 80s. Whew, what a story.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. So much back and forth with just that one like example. Imagine it's really interesting to trace all that, that again, that network, like we were talking about at the beginning. with that specific genre. And while we're talking about Soka 2, you're working on another project, correct, on Soka?
Yeah, I think one of the things that came out of this book of Jump Up was just how important Brooklyn was as a hub of Soka music during this period. I'd say, again, late 70s into the early 90s. And so I'm thinking of some way of doing a follow-up on that. And right now I'm working with a guy I mentioned before, Frankie McIntosh, who is... I'm working with this guy I mentioned before, Frankie McIntosh, who was one of the most important soca arrangers at that time, and who was in Brooklyn the whole time, and had easy access to Straker and to Ralston Charles, and they'd send Calypsonians over to his house, and they'd sing their song for him, and Frankie would write out the parts and come up with the harmonies for the chords. He would then call a recording session, get the musicians that would play, and you know that's how this music was recorded. Anyway, I've been doing a lot of work with him this fall, just doing a lot of interviews about his life. He came from St. Vincent. His father played in a calypso orchestra in St. Vincent, and that's where Frankie started, like when he was 12 years old. He told me a great story about hearing Calypso Rose visit when he was only 12 and before she was famous. But anyway, as I say, just his life story is very interesting, the way he eventually comes to the United States and settles in Brooklyn and so forth and becomes this incredible soca arranger. And I'm hoping to somehow that together, collaboratively, we can kind of tell a story of Brooklyn soca music in a lot more detail than what I do in the Jump Up book. And I'm also really interested in trying to work collaboratively. You know, I don't want to just do another book on, okay, here's soca music. Here's my view of it as this, you know, white ethnomusicologist looking in. I really want to work within the community and, you know, empower his voice and see if we can come up with some sort of collaborative text. I don't yet know how that's going to happen. He and I are working at it and talking about it. He's an interesting fellow because he, as I said, he was trained in music. And in fact, his knowledge and skills in terms of music theory are definitely outstrip mine. So, you know, we're an interesting kind of pair, if you will. And we'll see what comes out of that. But I hope, you know, maybe in a couple of years, you can bring me back on your podcast here and we can talk a little bit more about Frankie McIntosh and Brooklyn soca music. So that's the fantasy at this point. We'll see how that plays out.
That sounds great. And Frankie McIntosh can join us so we can have a great talk and learn
Absolutely.
More about that. Collaborative
Absolutely.
Process. That sounds like a great time. Well, thank you, Ray, so much for joining us today. We had a great time talking with you.
Well, thank you so much. It's been an honor to be here, and I hope people enjoy the book, and you know, I hope we can talk again soon.
Yeah, sounds great. And listeners, of course, we appreciate you as well. As a recap, this is the end of an interview with Dr. Ray Allen, author of Jump Up, Caribbean Carnival Music in New York City, published by Oxford University Press in 2019. This is Emily Allen, and please join me next time here on New Books and Celebration Studies, a special series from the New Books Network.